We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. Now here's your program.
And good morning. Welcome to Focus, hour number two of our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. We're here and doing a couple things. Well, as usual, we'll do the usual thing where we'll be talking about a particular topic, and we got a guest here. And in fact, it's one of our favorite guys. Dennis Barron is with us. He's professor of English and linguistics here at the U of I, and so we'll be talking about language and taking questions. We will also be trying to encourage people to support the station. One of the things that is such a pleasure for me in doing this show is that I get to have these great conversations with people and concentrate on just that. We don't have commercials on this station. People tell us they like that. Well, the reason we don't have commercials on the station is that listeners help pay the bills. You know, on commercial stations, well, the commercials pay the bills. Here, we don't have that. The government support continues to shrink, and the only place we can go to make up the difference is to listeners. And actually, we like it that way. We would much rather be beholden to the audience than beholden to the guys in Springfield or in Washington. So now's an opportunity for you to make a pledge of financial support to the station. Kimberly Cronick is here in the studio with me. She's our Director of Community Engagement, and she's here to help me encourage you to make a contribution.
Yes, and another important function of this show, David, that I enjoy is that you connect listeners to the guests as well as to yourself. And I think that's an important convening function that we play here at WILL. And we're looking forward to our conversation with Dennis Barron today. But before we get to that, we'd like you to pledge right now at 217-244-9455 or give online at willpledge.org and make a contribution. WILL is made up of people who listen, and it's made possible in part by listeners like you who give. About 40% of our operating budget comes from you. We are in need of raising $191,000 by the end of this month, and we can do that one pledge at a time. $52 is $1 a week. We bring you 10 hours of Focus programming every week. Figure out that that's not very much per show if you give $50 to dollars per week, but that helps us tremendously. 217-244-9455 or willpledge.org. We have a goal of 20 pledges during Focus. We had five last hour, and we're still getting the totals on those pledges, so I'll let you know later on in the program. But let's have your pledge in that amount, in that total amount right now, willpledge.org or 217-244-9455.
We're happy to have as our guest here on this hour of Focus, Dennis Barron. He's been a guest before on the program to answer questions about grammar. We have talked quite a lot about how language changes over time. We have given people the opportunity to complain about misuse. You certainly may do that. Any and all of that, you're welcome. You'll come right here to the program. No one will expect you to pledge. That would be nice, but that's not required. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And you may also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Dennis teaches here at U of I and also has authored a number of books about language, and the most recent is A Better Pencil, Readers and Writers in the Digital Age, which just came out last year from Oxford University Press and deals with some of the same sorts of things that we were
exactly
talking about with the last guest.
Exactly.
I'm looking at your picture.
It's an old picture
page on the website. We recognize it.
Well, I'm an old person, but it is an old picture.
I don't know what to make of this expression. It's bemused, quizzical. It's that expression that says, "Are you talking to me? Are you?" I don't know what was. What
you know,
was,
you've heard of you know. Let's bring up cinema studies as long as right. You've heard of the Kuleshov effect.
Refresh my memory.
Okay, let me refresh your memory. You see a picture of a person with some kind of blank expression, and you read into it what the context, what you've seen before, and the picture that you've just seen before. You look at they flash the picture of the neutral expression, and the audience reads into the picture what. You know, what what the person is looking like, bemused, quizzical, ironic, sardonic, sagacious,
all of the above.
Wise, well-read, relaxed.
That's really remarkable because I can see all
unshaven.
Of that. I can see all of that.
You can see all of that.
I can see all of that in that picture. All right. Well, if you'd like to take advantage of some of Dennis's sagacity, you give us a
call.
We'll
have to change. I see that you've got the department webpage up, and we'll have to change. I've got a new picture that the News Bureau took of me, which is very, very nice.
All right.
And better reflects what I look like now.
Did we?
I probably didn't have any pants on when they took that picture, but it's just a headshot.
Well, pants, you know? Optional. Well, that's right. That's right. In fact, you may have had one of those little shirts that's cut off
that right.
expose
yeah.
your midriff. We
right.
wouldn't even
right.
know.
Right.
We know that there's books behind you, so that's always
that's
a good
study.
Indication.
That's my study.
That's at home?
Yes.
Ah.
So, David, I'll cut in. So people need to go to our website to see this photo, right?
It's just, no, it's on the English department website. It's a perfectly legitimate regular old, you know, the
yeah,
kind of the, on the dust jacket on the book kind of
exactly
photo.
Exactly.
All right. So
yeah, it's quite tasteful.
All right. Very good. Did we talk? We didn't talk about the word of the year when we last talked, did we? I'm not sure that the word of the year had been.
I didn't even remember what the word of the year was. Now,
okay. In that case,
we're so far into 2010 that
if there were going to be, no, maybe I shouldn't.
What the word of the year for 2010 has got to be BP so far, right?
Oh, yes, could be something oil spill related.
Oil spill related.
I suppose I could even find out what the word of the year was. I tell you what, I'm going to be bailed out here by because I think we have a call.
We have a caller.
Henry? Oh, Henry. Do we have a is line number 4 a call? Oh, okay, very good. Thank you. Belgium, let's talk with them, line number 4. He'll bail us out here. Hello.
Yeah, maybe I will, but doesn't the word have to have some vowels in it? BP doesn't have any vowels in it. But neither.
Why should a word have to have vowels in it? Is that part of the definition?
Well, I don't know. I just kind of thought it'd make more of a word if it had some vowels in it. But okay, maybe it doesn't. But the
damn BP. How about that?
There we go. Yeah. That's better. Yeah. the question I was going to ask is there a difference? Is there a difference between bring and take?
Is there a difference between bring and take?
Other than the spelling, obviously.
They have different vowels, as long as we're talking about vowels, yeah. they imply certain kinds of things. So I mean, it's hard to talk about the major differences without putting them in context, but I think what you're probably pushing toward is bring means I'm here and something is coming to me in my direction, in my location. Take means I'm here and something is going elsewhere. It's a sort of hither, thither, and yon kind of thing. Location is involved typically in the difference between bring and take. Bring means something to the speaker's location, something's coming to the speaker's location. If you're talking about literal bringing and taking, when you say bring it on, that's more metaphorical, and it's not really talking about physical location so much as let me have it.
They seem to, everybody seems to do those either way. Sometimes you can bring something to me, or you can take something to me, or I can bring something to you, and I can take something to you.
Mm-hmm.
So they're used interchangeably. Now, I always thought, like you said initially, that that's mm-hmm. the way it was. But
yeah.
People confuse it constantly.
Yeah, that's because people don't behave the way we tell them to. If you have ever driven a car, you'll notice that many people don't drive the way you would like them to or the way the law says they're supposed to. So we do the same thing with language, and we're always so surprised that we do it with language, but less so when people say go 5 miles over the speed limit or drive too slowly for conditions. As well, people, you know, take these definitions and these rules, so-called, as suggestions rather than commandments. And so, yeah, we push the boundaries on things like bring and take all the time.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. See, that's what I expect from that guy whose picture I was looking at on the website.
Yeah. Now, what would you expect from the real
From the real Dennis Barron?
Right, right.
I don't know. Have I ever met the real Dennis Barron?
No.
I have to talk with Iris about that.
This is a persona.
All right. Yeah, and just for the record, by the way, according to the estimable American Dialect Society, the word of the year for 2009 was tweet.
Yes, okay.
Word of the year was tweet, and word of the decade, Google.
Yeah. Google.
Okay. So that's for anybody who pays attention to these things other than the members of the American Dialect Society, word of the year.
By the way, talking about how people use words the way they're not supposed to be used, and connecting that to Google, since you just mentioned Google, a couple of years ago, Google, the company, came out with a press release or an announcement or some sort of document in which they insisted that Google was not a verb, that you could not Google something.
You cannot Google something.
Right. You know, people are, companies are very sensitive about protecting their trademarks, and they don't want them to become generic. And that's fine, and that's totally expectable. You know, Xerox does the same thing. You can't Xerox something according to the Xerox Corporation. You make a photocopy using a Xerox photocopier. Or a Xerox machine. It's just a proper adjective, mm-hmm. according to the trademark folks. But I noticed that when I got my iPhone and it had Google as its search engine, and when I enter something into the search box, the option that I am given is not search or enter, it's Google, which to me means Google as a verb.
Yeah. That seems to me that for Google to try to do that, that's putting the proverbial toothpaste back in the tube. That's not going
to happen. I mean, here's the thing. You don't want your brand name to become a generic to the point where that means that competitors, people with other search engines, can use your name in their product. So, you know, there's a history of former brand names that have become generic, and they include things like Shredded Wheat and Zipper and Linoleum and things like that that also always used to be brand names but then became common words.
I've got somebody here ready to go, and we have an email question. Others would be welcome. We're here with Dennis Barron, who's professor of English here at the University of Illinois. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's talk with someone in Indiana, Mill Creek Valley, Indiana, line 2. Hello.
Yeah. I was interested. I'm always interested in language, and I taught language for a long time, English. That making nouns into verbs, Shakespeare did an awful lot of that. The only one that comes to mind is out Herod, Herod. But I called you because I want to relieve a very minuscule frustration in my life by answering a question which you posed about 5 years ago.
It's been bothering him for 5 years.
Well,
I've been appearing on this program for 20 years, so 5 years is nothing. Okay.
I very seldom happen to be listening when you're on, but this particular time I was. But I was driving home, and I did not have a car phone. And so I thought, maybe I'll get home. Maybe I'll get home in time. But
you were observing the speed limit, as well you should.
Well, the phrase was, and I hope it doesn't offend people, but that was the phrase, nigger in the woodpile. And one of your callers asked, and you didn't know the answer at that time, as to what that referred to. And what that referred to was the people along the Underground Railroad, one method of hiding slaves, escaped slaves, runaways, was to hollow out a space inside the woodpile and put them in there.
Okay, I actually don't remember that coming up ever when I was on the show, but perhaps you're confusing me. There are some other people who talk about language.
Yeah, well, I was myself, English professor there at IU, but even if it wasn't, I've still relieved my minuscule frustration, so thank you very much.
All right. Other questions are welcome. People would like to resolve their frustrations, we'll try to give them an opportunity. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. I do have an email here from someone who writes, how do I, as an adult, tell another adult that they are consistently misusing the pronoun I, as in, please give the books to Jim and I?
Yes, well, good luck with that, because that has become the collocation, somebody and I, my brother and I, Frank and I, so on. So, typically, when those come in object position, it should be me, but that X and I has become a kind of very common idiom in certainly in American English, and I'm not sure about its occurrence in British English, but I think it might be happening over there too. And there's people have been complaining about this for 20 years or more. People who use that expression never make mistakes between I and me when it's not a compound. They never say give it to I. They say give it to me. So it's not a really a question of ignorance. It's of which subject or object form you should use. It's just become an idiom, and there are people who hate it, and there are people who just use it and think it's totally natural, and never the twain shall meet. So you, as an adult, good luck with that, which is, I think, how I started this explanation. There's not much you can do about it except... I wouldn't bother them with it because the people don't like to be corrected, especially by other adults. Mm-hmm. I, as an adult, this suggests to me that you would be perfectly willing to chastise a child who said it. Think about that, you know.
Why?
And that would have just as little chance of success, I think.
No, absolutely. If you're thinking about this, if you take the time to think about it, and at least in that particular case, you say, well, if you're not sure, if you drop out the other person, it becomes clear that what it
is. But it's it always appears in this compound.
Yeah.
And one of the explanations has been, well, people, as children have had drilled into them, don't say me for the subject form, me and Charlie went to the store, say I, and then somehow that carried over into adulthood. But that doesn't sound like a very satisfactory explanation.
Hmm.
To me, because people never make the mistake except in the compound. Or never use it. I can't even call it a mistake anymore because it's so common. People never use the form except in that compound expression.
Yeah. All right. Other questions are welcome.
And sometimes they will. We also plug in myself instead of I.
Lot
of times.
Yes.
And I think it's just a kind of. I think the response is that we have been. In that case, sort of conditioned not to be very egotistical and to avoid I, that the sense to pushing myself is a little bit more not so much out there. I don't know.
Why?
There are no real explanations. These are just sort of guesses. But that's another one that people have been using, plugging in that myself when they should just say me. It's a me avoidance.
Is this something that people have been complaining about for a long time, or
Well, a long time. Yeah, 20 years, maybe 30 years, maybe 40 years. Yeah.
Dennis Barron is our guest. He's professor of English.
I am your guest. I'm professor of English and linguistics.
We're very pleased to have him here. He's written a number of books about English.
Let me make a comment.
Yes.
Going back to some of the stuff that Clay Shirky was saying about information overload and information glut. And so one of the interesting things that I have found in looking at the sort of the history of technology and reading and writing is that there has always been too much to process. We look around and say, oh, there's information everywhere and we need filters. And that's true. But, think about the ancient Library of Alexandria, which is often held up as a paragon of information collection in the classical world.
Hmm.
There never was anybody ever who had read everything in that library. which was said at some point to have held maybe a million scrolls and manuscripts and what we would consider books. No one ever read all of that stuff then either. It was too much. There's always been too much information to absorb. So the key is learning to manage that information. How do we look at the collection of information and retrieve what we need from it? Search engines, catalogs, subject indexes, librarians, all of those things have developed as a way of sifting through information, pre-arranging it for us, systematizing it for us, so that the user can get what they're looking for more easily.
Huh. Kim, you said earlier that you wanted to ask a question.
Well, that's a good point, what you just made, that connection between the earlier conversation today. And he also makes that point about we've always been overwhelmed by information. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think one of our functions is to help people get connected to certain kinds of information. But we are having so much fun with language today, and I've never heard you on the show before, so I feel very happy to be in the studio with you today. I love it when words are both nouns and verbs. You mm-hmm. talked about Google. Mm-hmm. My favorite one is pet. I can pet my pet, both a verb and a noun. Mm-hmm. I just think that's funny.
You can pet if you're.
I can pet my partner too.
If you're in a pet, you can pet your pet, and that might relieve your pettishness. Think about that. I mean, to pet meaning to be in a bad mood.
I love it. It's good stuff.
In a pet. No?
I don't know that expression.
That?
No.
Maybe that we just say that in Queens. No, we never said that in Queens.
Is that is that from American English?
I guess.
In America.
Okay. I don't want to cause a controversy, but
you've been watching the World Cup.
Row. There might be a row. No, that's from listening to the BBC.
Yeah.
Actually, for way too many years.
Way too many years.
Yeah. All right. Dennis Barron is here. We're here open to questions. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email. Will, I'm told email is just over. But if you'd like to email us.
Do we tweet?
We're not. No, not yet. We're kind of behind the curve here.
Where's Jack on this?
Yeah, there's only
Don't
so
worry,
much more Jack
talking about
can do. You know, I'm 57 years old, and I'm not yet tweeting, so
Do we have a Facebook page?
No. Well,
wait, yes.
Well, WILL
WILL
does.
That's what Focus
I mean.
Does not
I don't
have
mean
a,
by we, you.
Dave does not.
Straight.
Focus does not. The radio station
does.
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Yes.
We're still. It's just we're working on trying to figure this stuff out. It's a little beyond me. I think some people are definitely more advanced than I. But
myself.
You thought that pronoun very carefully.
You bet I did.
Hey, we got
and
callers.
The lines are lighting up.
Okay.
Before we go back to, before we do some more calls, we need to ask for money. How about that?
Yeah,
Kim, you
very
can
easy.
Do that.
Easy thing to do. 217-244-9455 or willpledge.org. David, we set a goal of 20 pledges during Focus. The first hour, we did get 10. We got 10 pledges, and 9 of them were through the website, willpledge.org, and 1 was through Ma Bell. So great. Matters not to us how you make a contribution, but that you do. We need to hear from 10 more listeners who become financial supporters of WILL. 217-244-9455 or willpledge.org. You know, one of the things I like about Focus is the conversation that occurs here in the studio over the phone. We invite you to be part of that. We then archive this on our website so that you can go back and listen. You can share it with others. We do act as a sort of filter. We believe that you have empowered us to act as that filter of credible information that you can trust, that you can interact with. We think that's an incredibly important function, even more so as more information is available. We'll continue to explore our role in connecting you to people and information that you can use in your daily life. Give us a call and make a contribution. $40 is the basic membership, or how about $1 a week? That's $52. We can get you one of those Mango Chico bags that you can take to the farmer's market or your grocery store. But call now, please, at 217-244-9455, willpledge.org. And thank you for the 10 people who've already contributed this morning.
Our guest, Dennis Barron, professor of English linguistics here at the U of I, author of a number of books about language. And I do it because we have been talking so much about the digital age and what it means for reading and writing. That's the subject of his most recent book. It's titled A Better Pencil, and it's published by the Oxford University Press. Just came out last year, so if you'd like to read some on that topic. And he has a blog.
The Web of Language. Which has the recent picture.
Ah, all right then.
To see what I really
used to look like. And if you're interested in other little writings about language, Web
There's
of Language.
There's a new technology post that I put up last night about Kindle.
Oh, all right then. Well, we have callers. Have we got callers? We have callers, and we will talk with them in the order they came in, starting with someone in Mattoon. Line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I heard you mention watching the World Cup, and that has given me a new favorite word for those long plastic horns they're blowing all the time. Vuvuzela. It just is sounds like such a nice word.
It's an annoying word for an annoying sound.
Yeah, it is an annoying word.
No, it's a nice word for an annoying sound. Yeah.
Yeah, but the word seems so nice. It rolls off the tongue so nice that it should be added to our language, I think.
Well, I think it already has inserted itself indelibly into our consciousness.
Hopefully it will not start appearing at sporting events here in the United States.
My son even has a Vuvuzela app for his iPhone. He can make his iPhone imitate that sound.
That's amazing. Well, thanks for the show. All right. Always enjoy it.
Thank you. We're totally lost then in that case. I actually was... I like the word myself.
I prefer the lightsaber app myself.
What does that do?
It makes a...
Oh. I went because I
like...
As
you wave the phone in the air.
I don't even...
Get digital, David.
I'm an analog guy.
You're an analog kind of guy. I'm living in a digital world. That's why you're still on the radio.
That's why I'm still on the radio.
Is that a new song?
Yes. I think I could write a song.
An analog guy in a digital world.
It sounds like a good... It would make a good country song, wouldn't it? Wouldn't it? I was going to say, I like that word so much, I went to look it up, and apparently there's some controversy about where the word comes from.
Okay.
Partly, somebody has guessed that the vuvu part, it's onomatopoetica.
Yes.
It's that's like sort of like the sound that it makes.
Okay.
Or that it's possibly it comes from, I think it was from Xhosa, one of the languages of South Africa. But I guess apparently no one's really, which is the click language. Nobody apparently is really sure where vuvuzela came from, but it's a South African thing. They have something like it in South America, but they call it something different.
Right.
Yeah.
Sure.
Right.
Okay.
So
so when the World Cup is in Brazil, we'll find that out.
I guess. If it ever comes to the United States, we'll definitely find out.
Yeah. We've got the Bronx cheer.
Oh, now Henry, who's actually paying attention to the show, unlike me, says that, in fact, recently at a major league ball game, they did have, I don't know if he's joking, they had a Vuvuzela night, so and probably regretted it afterwards. So that would mean that they actually passed them out to everybody who came to the game, I guess.
Okay, so I heard something yesterday, I don't know if it was on The Daily Show or Colbert or something, saying... Or maybe it was on the radio saying that some mechanical sounds like that were banned at a Yankees game. And I don't know. It was on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. They were amazed that anything annoyed Yankee fans enough to ban it.
All right.
Speaking as a former Yankee fan myself.
Let's go on and talk with someone else. This will be Champagne, line two. Hello.
Hi. I have just a quick question. Irritates me, but maybe I'm pronouncing it wrong. But I've heard the president call the Marines, et cetera, the Marine Corps, and I always thought it was Marine Corps. I'll hang up and just listen to your comments.
Really? Well, that's interesting.
Well, I haven't heard him say that, but it is Corps, Marine Corps, even though it ends in an S or a PS. We don't pronounce this.
Where does that come from?
PS. Well, it's from corpus. It's from Latin.
Oh,
ultimately,
okay.
Corpus. But in modern English and in French, you say corps.
Why has the
S corpus
dropped?
Delicti,
yes.
Corpus meaning a body of work.
Yes.
And so on. Just over the centuries, the sounds we stopped saying
so that. So why didn't we drop off and then just
we
drop
do say
off
corpse.
The S?
We do say corpse for body.
Right.
Okay, and that ends in an E. I mean, we spell it differently from core, but they all come from the same word, and it just means body.
And so why?
Collectively and or individually.
And why now over time, if we don't pronounce
no
it, why haven't we just dropped the S off of there?
Then just call it C-O-R.
Oh, that were C-O-R-E.
Core. That would be an interesting and you know, imaginable folk respelling of the word, the core. Because, you know, C-O-R-E, essential part of something. That,
sure.
That would fit.
Sure.
We don't, though. There are traditions in the core.
Well, that may, I can see that that would indeed be a tradition in the core. That's just if
how
that's
you spell
the way
it,
you,
how
that's
you
how you spell it, how you pronounce it. That's just the way we do it.
And I can't imagine that the president mispronounced a word like that.
I find that very difficult to believe.
He's a very eloquent guy. Whatever you think about the politics, you cannot fault the elocution.
All right. Other questions, welcome. 333-9455.
Unless you're on Fox News.
Toll free 800-222-9455. Email Will.
He uses words that are too long. That was the criticism of the White House speech. His language was too elegant, too adult.
Really?
We just can't. Americans aren't ready for a smart president.
Well, apparently also some people think they aren't ready for someone who is emotionally sort of level. I mean, that's the other thing.
Right.
That
we
gets
want
me
our presidents
that,
to go off, you know,
I guess,
and yelling and screaming and tearing their hair and act like they're on Fox.
The guy's just too cool. That's I find it very interesting. That's something that people find to object to, that he's not emotional enough.
They haven't been watching, you know, old films of Woodrow Wilson or Franklin Roosevelt was not, you know, wildly emotional in his public.
No, nor can I really think of
Kennedy.
Any Kennedy, Nixon,
right. So, Lyndon Johnson, you know, show you his scars, curse at everybody, but
that you know, yeah,
Eisenhower wasn't like that. Yeah. Eisenhower in public, no, Eisenhower was very calm.
I wanted to ask you, going back to the Better Pencil.
Yes.
And maybe we talked about that book, so maybe we talked about this, but whether you have seen either out there in the world or with students, do you think that the fact that they're writing on computers or maybe they're sending text messages or they're tweeting or whatever, those that the tools that people are using now, are they changing the way that people actually use the language, and are they changing the way that people write?
Sure, and that's always been the case. I mean, the tools of literacy technologies have always interfaced and somewhat shaped how we read and write, and the needs of readers. I mean, this is the thesis of the book: the needs of readers and writers, in part, direct how these tools develop, and in turn, the tools shape how we are able to read and write and communicate. You know, the technologies, digital technologies, let us do all kinds of things that we weren't able to do with print technologies. Print technologies let us do all kinds of things that we couldn't do with handwritten technologies. And writing technologies let us do all sorts of things we could never do just by talking.
Are people writing shorter sentences?
People have been writing shorter sentences since the 18th century. You know, in English, anyway, sentence length has demonstrably decreased. Now, I don't know if that's partly a function of changes in punctuation convention rather than technology or anything like that. We just put the period earlier in the thought. The thought lengths maybe are the same, but we just chunk them into sentence units that are shorter rather than having long, what we used to call periodic sentences, lots of clauses. Each clause then becomes a single sentence. So, I mean, by looking at different writings over the time, you can count words per sentence and see that there's been a decrease from the 18th century to through the 20th century. Does it have to do with technology? No, I think it has to do with changing taste. Will we see sentences that are no longer than 142 characters? I don't know. What's the Twitter length? Is 130?
I think 100. I thought it was 140.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. You know, will all our communications start sounding like haiku?
That one might be interesting.
That'd be interesting.
All right. Let's talk with a caller here. Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
There's a use that has begun that I wanted your opinion on. When I was younger, I used to hear the phrase fraught with danger or fraught with something or other. But nowadays, people are just saying the situation is so fraught.
Yes.
What in the heck does that mean?
It's fraught. Yeah, I know. That's because nobody knows what fraught means. Right? I mean, fraught has become unmoored from its original meaning, which is, and you can tell me, right? Fraught with danger, it means
full
what?
Full of.
Full of. It is related to, it is the past tense of what? Well-known word.
I have no idea.
Freight.
I don't know.
Freight. Instead of freighted, freight.
Freighted.
Fraught.
Okay.
Freighted.
It's
so loaded,
loaded
with.
Up
loaded
with.
Loaded up with. Oh. Yeah.
Well.
Yeah.
All right. Huh. Thank you. I was afraid of that.
Yeah. Yeah. And so since, I mean, it is just, you know, unabashedly old-fashioned. We don't use fraught as the past tense of
well,
freight
we're beginning to use
anymore. And so when we have a word that has become detached from its sort of etymological sense and its semantic sense, we're free to assign it to anything we want. And so, yeah, fraught with danger, it's fraught.
Assigned.
It's fraught,
I've heard it on the air 3 or 4 times in the last month. Thanks a lot.
All right, thank you. I'm just tickled with the idea that somebody would use the word like fraught.
Yeah, well, sure, people do. People are, even in the digital age, there's a place for fraught. It's like wrought, right? Wrought is the past tense of worked.
Uh-huh.
Reek, wrought.
What hath?
God. Wrought.
Or the internet.
Wrought iron.
Wrought, yes.
Wrought iron, right?
Yes.
We use it in
wrought.
It means worked iron, bent, shaped in some way. But it is a very old-fashioned sounding word, and it's used only in a couple of senses, and nobody really knows. Nobody really connects it to the original.
Yeah, sure.
Can you, I've heard that fraught with danger, but can you say fraught with love? Does that work? Is that factually
correct? It could work, but it just doesn't sound idiomatic, does it?
We're saying that fraught, if something is fraught, it's always going to be bad.
Yeah.
It's never going to be a good thing.
Yeah, it's
right.
a negative thing or a serious thing or, I don't know, yeah, weighty.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Okay.
Well, let us go to line 4 for the next caller on toll-free line. Hello.
Hi. I've noticed recently on communications with Facebook from family and friends across the pond that they're now using the OF of instead of have when it comes to should.
Oh, yeah, should have, could have, would have.
Yeah, I'd just be interested in listening to your comments on that, and I'll listen offline.
Well, it's sort of, you know, here's a couple of traditions here that are contributing to that. One of them is just kind of phonetic spelling. Again, forgetting that apostrophe V-E is how we would spell it. We don't say should have. I should have done that. You say I should have done it. And it's unstressed, and we sort of unmoor it from our sense of it being connected to have. And of is spelled O-F, so okay, yeah. But there's also a tradition of hard-boiled American detective story writing in the 30s and the 40s where that was the spelling in print of those things in dialogue, and it was sort of, I don't know, it was just a convention. It was not done through ignorance, but on purpose to just sort of indicate a kind of, I don't know, educational level of the speaker, toughness of the speaker. It was just a stylistic feature that
I should have known. I should have been quicker on the trigger.
Yeah, and
I
would spell it should. They spell it as two words. Should O-F.
O-F.
Yeah. And it was part of that narrative voice of the hard-boiled detective, the Philip Marlowe kind of guy.
All right. Very good. That's another example.
And
of
I'm not sure where that started with because, you know, read some of that stuff, but no, I didn't read the old, you know, pulp magazines where those stories started. So it may have come out of that tradition.
But it was
there's an old 19th century tradition of American journalistic writing with deformed spellings of all kinds to produce a comic effect. That's what, you get Mark Twain's kind of stuff was coming out of a journalistic tradition of comic writing in that period. He didn't invent that. There are a lot of people who are doing it.
Yeah. Well, let's go again to another caller. Line one. Hello.
When we hear the word collateral in relation to some uses in collateral damage regarding the war, we also have the current situation about the oil flood catastrophe that is going on in the Gulf and its ripple effect and untold consequences. And, of course, we have go back to Hiroshima with the horrific destruction that occurred. So this simplifying what has been going on in the war with bombing and so forth and simplifying the deaths of lives and so forth and property and resources and so forth with the simple comment collateral damage seems to minimize extent. Of course, when we talk about a picture, it's worth a thousand words. I don't think that this use of collateral in relation to simplifying it or even ripple effect are significant. So horrific and other words come to mind. And so I was wondering what you thought of that.
Yeah, there's this whole sort of public discourse dealing with disaster that seeks to clean it up, that seeks to minimize, seeks to sanitize. And, you know, calling, accidentally killing lots of people by dropping a bomb in the wrong place. Collateral damage is a kind of sanitization of sanitizing of what happens. It's a euphemism for it. Yeah, I guess I agree. If I could understand sort of what the caller was focusing on, I think that's what it was. He's objecting to that sort of cleaning up of the language to minimize how bad things really are.
I think she's saying that there are sometimes we're actually willing to be quite honest and straightforward and say something is something, and then other times when, for whatever reason, we're not so forthright.
Right.
All right.
Kind of thing Orwell was complaining about in Politics of the English Language, that people use these sorts of use language to minimize the seriousness of situations, and that's an illegitimate use.
We have about 5 minutes maybe here with Dennis Barron. We have some other callers. We'll try to get at least one more, if not both, here on line two. They're the next. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Yes.
I love when you do these shows. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. We love having people say that, and we love it even more if they pledge there. I said it. Okay, but go ahead.
I also pledge, or my family and I do.
That's great.
Over the past few years, I've noticed that when you say thank you to young people,
They say thank you back.
They no longer say thank you. They no longer say you're welcome. They say no problem.
Ah, no problem.
No problem.
No problem.
Like fingernails on the chalkboard to me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if you know where that came from, and I'm wondering also if you've noticed a age distinction and where about that age. You know, where does that? I don't notice anyone in their 40s or 50s saying that to me, but all of my students, I say thank you, and almost all to a person, my students will say no problem.
Okay, well, they are not trying to annoy you. I mean, they are.
I'm
they
sure
are.
Of that.
You know,
sure of that.
I know you react as if it's fingernails on the chalkboard, but. That's not the intention. I guess I've noticed this, and I suppose it's age graded. In other words, that there's a distinction that occurs in some age groups, but not others, and that it's younger to older. Why do people do it? The general principle is the more you use a word, the less it means. the less significance it carries. And things like greetings and thanks and your welcomes, because we use them so much in our interchanges with other people, tend to mean very, very little semantically. They have what we call very, very light semantic load. And so one of the things that happens is people sort of get the sense that your welcome isn't really doing it. And they look for some alternative, or they get tired of just saying you're welcome. They look for a variant in the pattern. They pick up something new, something more trendy, something more hip. So those things do sort of change a lot. We don't always say thank you. We say thanks. We say a variety of not too many, I guess, alternatives to that. But the you're welcome part seems to
thank you, Goose. Thank you, Gibbs, for pledge drives.
Yeah. You always have to keep bringing it back to the own pledge drive, don't you?
No problem, Gibbs, for pledge drives. There you go.
Well, thank you very much.
You are welcome. See, this came up. I know this came up on a previous
program. It was nothing.
Program.
How about that? It was nothing.
And I think that someone asked about that, and also I think someone made the point that often now when you hear you say to someone thank you, rather than them saying you're welcome, they also say thank you.
That's what I thought the caller was going to, because that I've heard objections to that.
See, my and maybe
it's sort of after you, Alphonse. No, after you.
I sort of thought. Well, I wondered whether in fact, if the shift from you're welcome to no problem, say, my thought was what you're welcome says, it says something like, I am happy to do this thing for you for
yes,
which you have thanked me.
Sure.
But if I say
no
problem, it's like it does not inconvenience me to do this. It's like, it's more sort of dismissive somehow.
Well, it you can view it that way if you are that paranoid, but it could be simply a polite way of saying it was so easy for me to do this for you. I was so happy to do it for you.
It
didn't put me out at all. Don't trouble yourself about it.
So it doesn't. It could be. It's not necessarily a negative.
It's not, they're not telling you to get lost. They're you know, necessarily. I mean, they could be. Sure, they could be. Sometimes paranoia is. I mean, you're not paranoid if they're really out to get you.
Yeah,
right.
Quite so. Quite so. We're about at the point here. I think we're going to have to wrap up. And I'm sorry. I think maybe rather than launch into another call, we're going to finish for this time round with the promise that Dennis would come back another time. He's always been very generous. We had a last minute guest fallout, so we called yesterday afternoon and said, could you come over? And being the guy
he is, bar of chocolate,
did you say no problem?
I don't think I said no problem. I think I said I'd be happy to. It was no problem.
And we thank
you. It was really quite inconvenient for me, frankly.
But he did it anyway.
But I did it anyway. You don't know how put out I am about this.
Well, and Martha gave you chocolate.
Martha gave
you
chocolate.
Martha Dio, one of our producers, gave him chocolate. Well, thank us to the callers. Thanks to Dennis for being here.
It was no problem for the callers. I'll speak for them.
All right.
And no problemo.
If you'd like to read about reading, writing, and digital technology, look for his most recent book, A Better Pencil, published by the Oxford University Press. Is that still in hardcover now?
Not in paperback yet, but there are Kindle and Mobi Pocket versions of it.
All right. So if you're that much on the cutting edge.
Not sure if you can read it on the iPad. I'm not sure if they did a deal with Apple yet.
Do you have a Kindle?
I do not have a Kindle. I do not have an iPad.
You don't have any e-reader?
I tried reading a book on my iPhone just to see what it was like, but I haven't got a one of my objections to the Kindle is that you don't own the books that you technically buy from Amazon. They are leasing them to you. Just the way you don't own what you buy from the iTunes store. They can always take it back.
And they can take your book back? They can snatch it back off?
Oh, they have done that. Didn't you know? They were selling some copies of 1984 and Brave New World that they found out they didn't actually own the rights to, and they went into people's Kindles and silently erased them.
And that's like right out of 1984
and
Brave New World.
I wrote about it on my blog. It's on the Web of Language. Check it out. Google it.
All right. Well, there we'll have to
pledge first.
Finish, yeah. But before we go, yes, definitely pledge.
Yeah, this is a great time to pledge. And we actually had another web pledge, and the person who pledged said, I pledge to support Focus, David Inge, and Dennis Barron.
Okay.
We thank you. We are more than halfway there. We wanted 20 pledges during Focus. We're more than halfway there. We thank you for your contribution. Give us a call right now and make a pledge before we get into Afternoon Magazine. The number is 217-244-9455 or, as always, willpledge.org. We had a lot of fun this morning talking about language, and we are near the end of our fiscal year, and we do need to raise $191,000 to support the programs you enjoy here. And we know we can do it with your pledge of support. You've come through before, and we're asking you to come through again. 217-244-9455 or willpledge.org.